Good bread, good meat. Good gosh, here comes the colonel.
Oh, yeah, cast of thousands on this program. Yes, and they all think they're comedians. All right, welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Today, of course, we're studying the business of nanotechnology with Charles McGovern, co-founder of INSCX Exchange, Commodity Exchange, for nanotechnology. He's in the U.K., and it's pretty interesting because INSCX Exchange has just recently endorsed the merger of Nanotox and Assured Nano. That is pretty interesting because it affects the quality of nanomaterials. So we're going to hear more from him. We also, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But now let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Ah, I see that with the coins in the fountain, we have summoned the spirit of the fountain. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here's an easy one for you. What was the world's principal Christian city before it fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453? The world's principal Christian city before it fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453. What city is it?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the others.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Can't fool you, and probably can't fool most of the people in the audience. That was an easy one. The world's principal Christian city before it fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453? Constantinople. Yes, Constantinople. Now, of course, it's known as Istanbul. All right, on with our show. Okay, when we broke at the half hour, we're talking to Charles McGovern, co-founder of INSCX Commodity Exchange in Nanomaterials. We were questioning him about the regulation of commodities.
There is actually no international body that exists to regulate commodities anywhere in the world. There's a regulation agency in the United States which regulates financial commodities, which is related to regulations pertaining to investment capital. And there are registration agencies such as the EPA in the United States and REACH. But they do not police the day-to-day operations of industry. They do not structure price tolerances. They do not provide industry with the means to be able to plan or procure materials. They basically just register a material, pass it as safe, and basically insist that a producer must file with them that they are actually supplying a given material. And the industry needs much more than that to be able to develop itself as commercial footing, because with all due respect, Ford Motor Company use steel because they know exactly the quality of the material they're getting. They know exactly how to plan the procurement process, the pricing process, in relation to using that material.
Yeah.
Within nanomaterials, the price differences between one supplier and another are enormous. I mean, for example, we had an inquiry in relation to magnesium oxide, and the difference between the lowest supplier and the highest supplier was something about 180%.
Whoa.
Now, with that sort of volatility across the supplier base, how do we expect any industry to be able to put itself reliant on that material?
Yeah.
We're just making it more difficult for ourselves. And equally, we've come across viewpoints from people who say that nanomaterials they're not commodities. They're not raw materials.
No.
So what exactly are they then?
Yeah, sure.
If you're going to use a material in a production process, well, I'm sorry, it is a raw material, and we can't get away from that point. It may be unique, it may be special, it may have different characteristics, but if we're going to expect industry to base its reliance or dependence on those materials, then we need to actually sit down and analyze how industry actually buys and sells materials in the existing world today.
Oh, absolutely.
They don't do so from shops, they don't do so from the internet, they do so in accordance with very strict commercial standards, which include inspection, accountability, the use of financial instruments, the use of forward trade, and if we're serious about commercializing nanomaterials, we need to be able to gear ourselves up to operate in the same footing. For example, we're seeing immense opportunities for the use of nanomaterials in the polymer industry at this present moment in time, and significant interest from the petrochemical industry. These industries are already organized, by and large, on a commodity exchange footing. So if we're going to try to appeal to them, then surely we must have the same mechanism in place that they're used to.
Yes, that makes so much sense, Charles. Now, one of the questions I know that our listeners are going to be wondering about is,
How active is your board of directors? How do you decide on their involvement? What global perspectives do they bring to the exchange?
Well, the exchange is structured, it's sometimes very difficult for people to understand what an exchange is, bar what they see on their TV screens or pictures of the floor in the American Chicago and so forth. Well, first of all, Inks Exchange is an electronic exchange. It's not a physical floor exchange. We may very well move to that structure, as indeed when nanomaterials, and we fully expect this to happen, nanomaterials bed down and be regarded as investment-grade commodities in due course. I think that will develop. The existing commodity industry that we see, for example, the investment commodities of oil and so forth, started off in very, very similar the same way, or wheat or copper or metal. It was where the exchanges themselves were founded by the suppliers, the manufacturers of the materials, and the other side of the coin was actually the trade users who actually wanted to use the materials. And what we have to appreciate is that institutions like Wall Street and so forth, Goldman Sachs, whatever, they came after the creation of commodity exchanges. They did not come before. The Kansas Board of Trade was founded in 1848. The London Metal Exchange was founded in 1577. The American Chicago, I think, came a little bit later in 1919. And the various boards of trade that you see in Chicago at the moment, where the vast majority of the world's raw materials are exchanged day in, day out, they were formed in the 1870s. And the other side of the coin is we have to weigh up the issue of standards. The International Standards Organization wasn't founded until 1926 and constituted as it is today by 1947. And whilst we have lines into the ISO and so forth, we cannot suggest that we represent them in any way, of course, because it's a wholly independent body. But we are trying to cultivate a situation where if there is a series of specifications in nanomaterials set, that they can be used by various standards agencies of the world as a proof of actually what has been exchanged, a proof of actually what industry is using. And it's really about trying to get the industry to realize that just because the nanomaterial community tends to stem from the academic community is not, it's not a detriment to that community. The academic community provides the innovation, and it's up to the business community to provide the commercialization. We need to marry those two skills together. And we act basically on the exchange to have a board of governors that supervises the market, and that board of governors is constituted of the chair of nanotechnology. A Cranfield sits on that board. For example, Assured Nano will be represented on that board, as indeed will Nanotalk. The chairman of the exchange in the United States is the former head of trading at Bain Weber, the honorary chairman, and the chairman in Europe is a gentleman called Stephen Cash, who represents the UK body that was established to try and structure the compliant commercialization of nanomaterials. The difference is the board is entirely independent from the exchange and acts as a final arbiter. And it's up to the company operating the exchange to be compliant with the rules and best wishes of the board of governors. It's basically a structure that you would have replicated in any of the formal commodity exchanges that you have across the world. The difference is that the market pricing and the day-to-day trading activity is conducted by an independent firm again, who are again responsible for policing the market, who are responsible for maintaining price discipline, the routing of trade orders, and eventually the control of other brokers who will be approved and applied to be members of the exchange to service the interests of nanomaterial suppliers and nanomaterial buyers, as it were, you know.
Well, Charles, somebody in our audience have materials they'd like to be have listed on your exchange. How does someone go about getting his commodities listed on your exchange?
It's very simple. They simply just apply to the exchange, explain to them what specification of material that they wish to place on the open market. And I need to explain the concept of a commodity exchange and how an order is placed before they can understand perhaps the significance.
Mm-hmm.
When an offer of product is displayed on a commodity exchange, it is displayed anonymously. It lists the material, the price, and the quantity that is offered for sale, and obviously the price. It doesn't identify the supplier source, so it enables individual suppliers, and for example, if you've got many suppliers of a particular specification of nano-silver, it enables those suppliers to conduct their business affairs anonymously. And the brokers in the exchange and the specialists will never disclose the identity of somebody making a price until somebody actually agrees to actually do a trade, when obviously then the disclosure has to be made. The buyer has to be identified to the seller, because the buyer actually, or the seller, has to actually pass the physical product to the buyer. So the point is, it's an anonymous market. It's not an open source platform that you have on the internet where price information is not real. The prices that are displayed on the exchange are real, live, firm dealing prices, where you can actually deal at the price and the quantity and the given material that's advertised, whether it's a bid, which would be a buy instruction, or an offer, which would be a sell instruction. So for an individual supplier to list their material on the exchange is quite simple. They apply to join the exchange. There's a nominal registration fee that we charge. It's priced very, very keenly for the nanomaterials community, because we fully recognize that the last thing that nanomaterial suppliers need is a constant drain on their resources, whether that's through advertising or whether that's through trying to apply for this or that or the other. For example, a membership on the and one of the formal exchanges will probably cost $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's wholly unrealistic for the nanomaterials community. And our membership fees for a nanomaterial supplier are quite minimal. They're actually under $1,000. So what the individual supplier does is apply to the exchange, submit their specifications. We need to ascertain whether they've got intellectual property associated with that.
Okay.
Because if they do, then that intellectual property needs to be protected.
Sure.
And it needs to be built into the actual specifications, which means that that individual supplier would be the only person approved to supply to that specification. And it would be up to the individual supplier holding intellectual property to decide whether or not they wanted to license another producer to that specification. The exchange would be there to safeguard that intellectual property, which is very, very important, because I think at this present moment in time, intellectual property within nanomaterials is quite a red herring. There's no uniformity between different regions of the world as to the interpretation of intellectual property. I mean, for example, the same safeguards may not be in Asia as what you would have in the United States. But at least if you have a contract listed on the exchange where XYZ nanomaterial company is the only approved supplier, then the exchange will not source that specification or permit the sourcing of that specification from anybody other than that approved supplier. And the approved supplier in question can rely on the resources of trade finance and exchange finance to be able to upscale through use of forward contracts. And, you know, I personally cannot understand why the exchange has been launched for about a year now and has actually been operating on a live basis for about 6 months, why the nanomaterials community en masse is not trying to join it. They should be. We've opened the doors, as it were. We've made it as easy for them as possible to join the exchange. And really, I suppose, for want of a better word, they need to come down as a high horse and get involved. Because the strength of the market will be based on the strength of the number of participants in the market. And I think if we decide to follow the route that many non-exchange traded commodities have followed to commercialize nanomaterials, it will be organized chaos. We see it every day of the week in traditional commodities. And anything that is non-exchange listed, it is almost impossible to trade to actually transact a trade. We have, for example, I have a buyer at this present moment in time looking for several tons of high purity copper powder. It's a nightmare trying to find people to supply to it. It's a nightmare trying to find price uniformity. It's a nightmare trying to find whether or not a different manufacturer is going to accept this form of payment or that form of payment. There's absolutely no structure to it. We see it in the titanium dioxide industry, where there's absolutely no structure whatsoever at this present moment in time due to complexities that are inherent in the supplier base. We see it in minerals, where, I mean, there's absolutely no trust across international borders. And the reason why there's no trust is because there's no structure. If I wish to buy crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, I can do that in 2 seconds. I can call my broker and I can buy it off the mercantile exchange. I'm guaranteed a specification. I'm guaranteed absolute price transparency. But if I wish to buy a chemical, it will take me weeks to get a price quote. I'm sorry, but industry will not favor materials where it's so difficult to actually find out any information pertaining to them, particularly price. Price is of vital importance to any industry going forward. I mean, for example, can you imagine the U.S. auto industry having to rely on steel if the price of that steel was moving around 50 or 60%?
Yeah.
Every second week,
yeah,
you just
right.
couldn't base an industry on the use of that material. And that's what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to enable the situation where, and people are often confused about it, they think that commodities equals cheaper materials. some of the most expensive commodities in the world trade on organized exchanges. For example, nobody can say to me that platinum is a cheap commodity. It's about $59 a gram. Nanosilver is retailing on the market at the moment in different grades, starting around $354. So I think the whole concept that the idea of commodity equals some sort of dumbed-down material is an absolute nonsense, which the nanomaterial community needs to rid itself of.
Well, Charles, you're a passionate advocate, and you've been extremely informative, and I can really, really appreciate very much what you've brought to us today. Incidentally, where have we reached you? Where are you right now?
Actually, I'm just outside Manchester, actually. The exchange operates from a number of locations in the UK. Its central headquarters is based up with Nano Central in the Wilson Centre, where the board can be contacted and so forth. Its operations centre is based in London, and obviously as an electronic exchange, we have a number of remote brokers that are based worldwide. Some working from some brokers are working actually from their homes. We're working from the central office here outside of Manchester. I suppose it's not a city. It's quite a large town called Newcastle. The exchange can be freely contacted. There's a number of contact numbers at various locations, depending on what people wish to discuss. For example, the trading operation is run from Newcastle here. For example, the operations of the exchange is run from London. And obviously anything to do with the Board of Governors or standards and so forth is run from the central headquarters. And you have to appreciate that this exchange has not received any government funding or support or encouragement beyond the people that are involved in the exchange, and many of them of their own free will, spending their own time, particularly Grantham University Professor Ramsden. The university has spent numerous months of time trying to be supportive of the exchange, I don't think anybody can be critical of the caliber of the chair of nanotechnology at Cranfield University. It's probably one of the leading universities in the field in the world. There are several in the United States as well, of course, and particularly in Japan. So many people have actually contributed their own time at their own expense to try and develop this exchange. I've practically spent every dime I have trying to get it off the ground, and I'm going to continue to do so. We've managed to make significant lines into the capital market structures of London and New York. We have any number of tech-friendly investors and funds who are leaning towards nanotechnology are not alarmed by the fact that the industry just seems to be very, very technically orientated. There are quite a number of different auxiliary services that we can provide for nanomaterial companies, whether it's just general advice and so forth, and a lot of those services are free. We're not here to try and make money out of emerging nanoscience companies who are struggling to gain traction. Our success will be dependent on their success. The more that we can try and build an industrial dependence on nanomaterials will lead to more trade going through the exchange. And ipso facto, the exchange will collect its small levies and commissions and so forth for providing the market service. And meanwhile, the nanomaterial company itself that's actually using the exchange will find it probably one of the most strategic partnerships it should consider making in its entire history. We're not interested in taking shares in individual nanomaterial companies. We're interested in maintaining their independence and in providing the mechanisms that ensure that. I think there's a danger, obviously, of certain interest groups taking a backlash against nanomaterials by trying to elevate us all to, an irresponsible futurism and so forth, and trying to throw in analogies like GM or asbestos, et cetera, just to create a scaremongering and so forth. But I think the nanomaterial community needs to be extremely proud of the innovations that it's bringing to bear, and to take that pride and move it a step further, get involved with the exchange as the central body that will act in its best interest, and listen to its members, and have that strength of having a bit of confidence. The co-founder of this exchange, Mark Warburton, is an academic in nanomaterials, and it took me the best part of 2 years personally to understand 50% of what Mark was talking about. it's the nature of people from a technical background that sometimes they appear in a different way.
Yeah, I know.
But the innovations that these people can bring to bear really are the future of the global economy. I look at so many different things in nanomaterials, where we can provide into the basis for resource solution. We face a tremendous resource problem in the world economy today, whether it's in agriculture or whether it's in energy and so forth. And the innovations that are coming to bear through nanotechnology, if it gets capital support, will help solve those problems. I mean, for example, this fertilizer in agriculture will increase a wheat crop yield by 30%. That will reduce carbon emissions and so forth. And realistically, the opposition to actually the take-up of these materials is coming from existing industries where capital is committed to older processes. We're really talking about a new economy here and trying to lay the basis for that. I know, for example, that we need to calm our euphoria, as it were, and calm down and structure ourselves a little bit better. But it's the nature of the technical community to be euphoric about latest innovations. And if the business community isn't prepared to tolerate that, then they really don't understand the academic community. So what I'm trying to say is that there are, in my opinion, there are so many, and I think Tim over at Scientifica raised a discussion last week about the latest the sort of myriad of advisory panels and discussion groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that are created within nanoscience, advisory panels to this, that, and the other, that are actually doing very little to help at the coalface of nanoscience, which is the small companies that are trying to produce these materials to gain commercial traction. And we need to redress that balance. There's so many different committees. I mean, for example, we get invited to conferences all the time, and we don't attend many of them because they're commercially pointless.
Well, Charles McGovern, the co-founder of INSCX, the Industrial Exchange for a Structured Collaborative Market for Emerging Nanomaterials. It's been very good to have you with us today, and we thank you so very much. And we're running out of time, so we've got to go. But thank you extremely. We appreciate it.
And thank you for taking the time, and it's been a pleasure. Okay?
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
As we've developed as a species, we've gone through a bunch of different energy sources. And when we had the Industrial Revolution, we really discovered that having a lot of energy is really useful. It helps us, you know, manufacture things and gets us, you know, much more productive. We don't have to all just be farming all the time. And so we had this world where, you know, there were these fossil plants like in cities all over the place, and there was so much smog that you couldn't see anything, and, you know, you could go out at noon and it seemed like it was night. And so along came electricity as this huge improvement for society. And what electricity did was allow us to have all the power of these machines in our homes, but it moved the generation of those way out of the cities off into places where the smog wasn't going to bother you as much. And so there we sat, and here we sit, you know, using this electricity for wonderful things and doing, you know, great technologies with it and having iPods and everything. But electricity allows us to not realize where it's coming from. And so if it's coming from a way that isn't sustainable or isn't responsible, we don't really know it. And so I would ask people to just remember where it's coming from and pay attention to what's generating your electricity and try to, you know, focus on getting that to be something that's very responsible in an environmental and, you know, a resource way and a waste way and all that. And I've thought about that a lot, and I would suggest that nuclear energy is a very good way to produce electricity in a responsible way. This is Nick Turan. I'm a reactor physicist at TerraPower in Bellevue, Washington.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.